Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
I'm in a good spot today. I had good news and bad news about my leg. Good news is that I am healing up. Bad news is that they're not expecting full recovery until February of next year. The fracture that I had turned out to be a lot more severe than they had imagined when they took the initial x-rays. So the x-rays yesterday revealed that it was much more involved than they had thought at the time. So given that, and, you know, I'd love for it to be sooner than later, but I'm grateful that I'm going to have full recovery at some point in time.
Well, it's also good that we're old, Alan, because as you know, time goes faster when you're old.
That's right.
You and I, and Patrick's fine, but you and I are late on our Christmas shopping already, and it'll be February in a couple of minutes.
I hadn't thought of it that way, Tom. You just made me feel.
It's the upside, man.
It'll be here before I know it. I know that's true, but that is very true. That time changes as you get older.
I had a physicist as a client one time, and he explained to me how that is. And Dan Siegel is like this. There are people who can explain things to you, and while they're explaining it, it makes perfect sense, and you go, "Oh, of course, it makes I got it." And then you walk away, and then somebody says, "Explain it to me." But all I got from this guy was it made sense to me. Was it was about ratio. And it's like, and ultimately, that is when you're 4 years old, a year is a fourth of your life. When you're our age, it's not, you know. And therefore, that's why we can feel the wind going by us as we're rushing through time now. So, but I'm sorry about the delay. But I get, you know, with my cancer stuff with the getting over the recovery, it wasn't like your thing, but they did keep extending it and saying, you know, the last time I was in there was just a couple of months ago, and I said, when are my taste buds going to be back? And he said, oh, it'll probably be another year. I'm going like, what? You know, but I'm and they probably knew that all along, but I'm sort of glad they didn't tell me.
Yeah, you wonder, yeah. Right?
Yeah, but the best, I mean, I don't mean to take away from anything of that, but the best news is you're healing in the right direction.
That's what I was excited about. Then the PT therapist, the physical therapist, so that was a structural analysis. The next day I had a functional assessment, and that was more promising. I mean, in a lot of areas, my leg is doing a lot better. The two areas that I have a lot of weakness is in my quadricep. I cannot step with my left leg and stand up on a stair, pull myself up to the stair. I have to hold a handrail and use a significant amount of arms to pull me up. So that's one thing. And then hip abduction, like lateral movement, you know, walking to the side or putting my left leg up on the side of the stair. I'm really weak in that area. This fracture is what really took that away. So I've got my focus for PT. They gave me my marching orders. I've got some exercise to do at home. And so, you know, I'll stay on top of that stuff. If I've got direction with that stuff, I'm pretty good at it. So that's on that part.
Good.
Emotionally, I'm feeling very, you know, I've moved past the grieving point. The marriage is over. I'm accepting that this is the next phase of my life, and what that means is unfolding right now in some very, very good ways. So that's really great, man. I mean, I've been on 2.5 milligrams of Lexapro now for about, I'd say about 3 or 4 months, maybe a little longer. And I think I'm going to be stopping. I mean, I'm not feeling like I need it anymore. I'm not weeping anymore. Even when I was on the Lexapro, I was still weeping, but it took off the edge for a while. But I don't experience any of that. And when I see Jess, there's no longing to be with her anymore. It's so interesting. And you know, Tom, a very interesting thing is the more I am finished with that relationship and finished with no longer am I in love with her, a psychoanalyst call it decaffexing, is that you unattach your energy from that person, right? as I'm doing that, if I'm becoming detached, I can look at that relationship and be so much more objective about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Perspective distance is amazing. Yeah.
It's so helpful, man. I'll tell you, it really is.
That's pretty quick. I mean, that you were able to attain some level of objectivity, because that can take years and years and years. And so, I mean, I think that's a testament to the work that you do on yourself and your relationships, that you were able to shorten that window. if it's now that you're coming to some degree of objectivity, I think that's a win.
Yeah,
You can't. I mean, basically, this is that hindsight is insight. You know, what you're describing is what you're now aware of, not like something you thought yourself into. It's like you're noticing this. To your point, Patrick, it also means what, you know, we always say workshop, we always say we don't know what we don't know. It's like, he doesn't know what's coming next either. I mean, the truth is, you know, 6 weeks from now, he may be telling us another objective thing that he's become more aware of as he gets more. We're just in works in progress, man. Our job is to do the work and pay attention to what the results are. Well, I'm happy for you with that, because time, as we know, as I believe, that time does not heal all wounds, but time with us paying attention and actually focusing where we need to focus and doing the work we need to our wounds will heal.
And you know, I really want to attribute a lot of this progress I've made to the incredible support I've received from you, from Patrick, from Roger, from Herb, from all of our listeners, and the emails I've received and the calls and my friends and my daughter and my son. And
it's great to not be alone.
You know, as we've been talking through the years, and you guys know that one of the things I love to do is to relate Bill's idea of emotional sobriety to the bigger context of how, you know, many therapists are thinking about certain concepts that are highly, if not directly related to emotional sobriety.
Yeah.
You know, even what Tom has said, it's about looking back at some of the books he's written. He didn't realize at the time he could have easily labeled them emotional sobriety and this and emotional sobriety and this and emotional. See, in many of these other people that we talked about, and yesterday, well, the whole day was devoted to going through either therapists or theologians or philosophers and relating their ideas to emotional sobriety. And we talked about some of the antecedents, you know, some of the predecessors to Bill Wilson, looking at some of the contemporaries, and we were just starting to look at some of the people that followed Bill, like Nathaniel Brandon and those folks. So it was a really remarkable day. We did Marcus Aurelius yesterday, Tom.
Yeah.
You know,
I was going to say, I have a pocket version of Epictetus in Stoicism, and I had marked some things in. I marked things in here all the time that are basically emotional sobriety. It's like, yeah.
I refer to him as your boy Marcus. That's how I always think of Marcus Aurelius.
Everybody who's a Marcus fan always just refers to him as, like, we know him by a first name. Hey, Marcus. But you're right, though, Alan. I mean, it's because that's where the, I mean, where emotional sobriety really becomes, and go to something that Herb used to talk about more, is like it's the lens. If we look at all of this through the lens of emotional sobriety, it's kind of a magic trick. It's kind of amazing. It's like, wow, look how much actually fits into this idea. And again, more kudos to Bill's genius.
And he captured the spirit of the times. I mean, you can see that what he captured was what a lot of people have been talking about in a lot of different ways. And in many ways was anticipating some of the directions that we would go in the future with all this. So it was a very good day. But I realized at the end of it, we got through maybe 10 people, and we had another 10 people we could have done. And it's something that could be a series in itself.
Yeah, I just like doing the work. You're right. Because that's when you get past the academics of it and just do the work, that's personal stuff is the most interesting to me, and I think to you also. It's like because you don't know what's getting ready to happen, and that's the fun. That's the best teachers I've ever learned from have said, you know, what you do is you track the client. You go where the client's going, and that's where you go. You may make a suggestion for a direction, but if that's not a natural thing for them to do, you go which way they're going. I have my own vocabulary, but I very quickly will recognize if my vocabulary does not work for them, and my job then is to begin to learn their vocabulary, because it's just, it's, you know, again, it's all just fucking metaphor. So anything we do to help people heal can change. We can change how we do it. And those are the best therapists. Those are the people I've learned from. I've watched you do it. It's like, I feel best when I'm doing that, where basically I can pivot and change directions or change any little piece of something anytime it's not working.
Speaking of, I'm in my Jimmy Stewart arc, so I'm going stir crazy. I can't really move around that much. Jimmy Stewart rear window.
Are you looking out the window a lot? Is that the deal?
Trying not to. You don't want to look too closely in the suburbs, but I can't wait for your workshop.
That's the name of a book right there. You don't want to look too closely in the suburbs. It's like,
yeah. If you can help it. Yeah, but you've got one coming up like in a week and a half or something like that, right, Tom? And maybe Carol's going to be involved, like some kind of workshop.
Yeah, I think Carol will be there. It's just a 2-hour thing on Zoom, and I shouldn't say just. It's a 2-hour thing on Zoom, and it's just it's kind of back to the basics. It's called translating interpersonal to intrapersonal. It's just basically we always talk about. You know, my little nutshell is the first part of any problem that I must solve is that which is between me and me. You know, it doesn't mean there's not a problem between you and me, Patrick. It means though, if I need to first look and see what's going on with me, because I'm not going to, you know, and we see that in marriages all the time. As long as I'm not dealing with my shit, I'm not going to be able to work out my shit if I'm projecting it onto you. So, and a lot of times people just need some basic education and some practice in getting inside and understanding how I always say we talk to ourselves. We just need to get better at it, how to talk to ourselves. But also I think it helps a lot to help people see the relevance of dealing with the intrapersonal, the inner work, to the interpersonal, because a lot of times I think we get people do misunderstand that I'm saying, oh, no, you know, you don't have a right to an opinion about what's going on in your interpersonal life, or you don't. It's like, no. And we're all messed up. So I promise you, the people you're having issues with in your interpersonal life are messed up too. It's like, we just, Alan made a face. It was great. Like, shit. Yeah.
Like, don't I know it, brother?
But anyway, that's what it's about. It's because, you know, and ultimately it just comes back to effective growth moves from the inside out. You can't solve a problem that you can't define. And the best way to define them is intrapersonally first. And that's a lot to cover in 2 hours, but we're going to give it a shot.
Yeah, I got a lot out of the last two.
I have two spots open for that. So if anybody's listening who wants that, they need to email me pretty quickly.
Did I already get a spot?
Yeah, you're. Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
good.
You let me know sure. Right away. Yeah. Okay, yeah, cool. You let me know right away. I appreciate it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, when I do my check-ins about the state of my emotional sobriety, I feel like a consistent thread on the show is just how well I'm not doing with it. And I think yesterday we can file that. We can file it into that category. As many of us are aware, somebody took a shot at Donald Trump, and I did what they call doom scrolling. Which is sat on my couch with my phone out, and I just like fell into a cocoon of darkness for hours. And I credit all the credit to my girlfriend who was able to pull me out of it for like an hour here or there. And we had some dinner and watched a little bit of TV. But like I was just not able to disentangle myself from this kind of I don't know, this talk about like unrealistic expectations and unenforceable rules. I all of those come up for me when when I think of life in the third person a little too much, and when I get too absorbed into world events that I don't have any control over. Yeah, it takes me to a dark place. So that was rough yesterday. My ability to deal with it is hampered a little bit because I like to be active and I like to get out and I like to socialize, and I do things to kind of medicate some of this aspect of myself usually, which require the use of both my legs. And I only have the use of one at the moment. So that kind of, I don't know, it's another wrinkle. It's something I gotta work on. And sometimes you fight the good fight and sometimes you lose the good fight. And I just didn't feel like I could do much but give in to my dark side yesterday. So there's that.
Well, Patrick, I don't know if I've shared this with you before, but I very much identify with being where you are and have been with that. And it's like in mine was basically during the George W. Bush administration, which of course now seems like nothing, but it was heavy. And it was like I literally could not get away from it. I would get up in the morning and I would sit down at the computer and I would start writing or reading and all this other stuff about this stuff. And I mean, I would be late to work. It was like any other, it was an addiction. I would get lost. And so one of the things I think about, and I've heard for several clients already about this too. And it's like, this is, it's, I'm sharing my experience here is, like when you said you went to that scrolling, it's like I go, look, that's picking the drink up, man. It's like, call if you want, call me before you do that. Because if you pick it up, it's like you're not gonna stop. It's like it's the same as it's just the same as our addiction. And there are ways to understand that you're still participating in positive ways in this system without getting ourselves so fucked up and drunk. And it's painful, and I believe it's useless. So if I can help with that, I mean, I really do think it was not an easy thing for me to do, and it's still not at times. This yesterday was a big challenge to not pick up, but I did the exact opposite. What you did is I went away from everything. I was not gonna, because I knew what I heard my guys talking in my head about all that, and I was gonna stay away from it for now. And I acknowledged my fears, but kept moving. And I'm mildly uncomfortable today with it, but it's like I'm better. So anyway, I'm not suggesting I have all the answers. I'm just saying, as you're listening to you today, I have some experience with getting past that, if I can help.
I'll call you next time.
Okay, do.
When you fall into that, Patrick, what are you experiencing?
Fear, dread. I was asked about feelings. When I'm talking to somebody who's a little bit wiser than me, oftentimes they'll just try to bring me to an emotion just to get cut through all the webbing and get to what's that emotion. And yeah, I think it's just fear. It's I don't know, I think during 2020, I saw so many violent images. There was so much kind of, I mean, no shortage of violent images in 2024, but I think that there's just something of like a bloody spectacle, that like when I see it, it pings some kind of like there's just some adrenal response I have that's like, where I feel like my under siege in a weird way. And I think just yesterday, these kind of bloody images with all these violent connotations and all these kind of like this kind of like cultural rumbling beneath them, really freaked me out. And so I think, like, yeah, the so what the doom scrolling then became is, yeah, I don't know, maybe it's like a self-harming thing. It's like, you know, I'm feeling the fear, so I'm like taking more and more sips of it to kind of inure myself to it, or I don't know what it is. I can't intellectualize what was going on yet, but feels bad. That's what.
And you know, and you're not, you can't make an argument that it's good for you.
Nope.
Right. Okay.
But that's the best I got now, and it's thanks to you, Tom, is I'll reach out to you. I called my sponsor.
Okay.
He was on his way to the beach with his baby and his wife, and so I, at the very least, I did not burden him with, you know, any of my ramblings. I sent him some dog photos because earlier that day we'd celebrated my girlfriend's dog's second birthday, and
Absolutely. Well, one of the things I did, I sent you the kitten thing, didn't I?
I don't think so.
Patrick? Oh God, don't worry, you're going to be better soon. Yesterday, for all the people I heard that were hurting this, there's this, are they, I don't even know, are they GIFs or GIFs?
GIFs, like the peanut
GIFs.
butter.
Yeah, okay. Oh, okay. There's one that I have on my phone with that's a scene from Scrubs, and it's like this doctor has got a box full of kittens, and he's pouring it on the patient in the bed. He's like he, so it's it, so it's I've been sending that out to everybody. I thought for sure I'd send it to you, but it'll make you feel all better, and when you just imagine that. And only I'll tell you this, I sent it to Roger, and Roger wrote back and said, "What about people with cat allergies?" I go like, shit, Roger, come on, man. It's
But
like,
they'll be gone soon. It's okay.
well, then I told him this could be a picture of euthanasia for people with cat allergies, you know,
What a way to go.
kittyanasia. Yeah, but anyway, yeah,
Thank you. Please send it over. And
I will.
Tom, before we get to our story, which is it's an abbreviated story, it's the last in our series from the AA Grapevine. Can I just ask how your emotional sobriety is doing today?
I'm good. It's one of my main things I work with these days is kind of about my growing edge is working with procrastination and basically moving, and not stopping and looking at things a long time before I do them. And I'm having a good day specifically today with that. I got up moving and getting things done. Yesterday I did the same thing. I mean, we're talking about simple things. I fixed some, and I'm not very mechanical or any of that stuff, but I was able to fix some plumbing problems that we had yesterday, and that just felt like a major accomplishment. But it's also one of those things that historically I would just put off forever, and it wasn't, we had the other side of the sink that worked, so it wasn't an emergency. But it's like I got that done. I'm moving on some writing projects that I've been putting off. So and I'm not trying, I'm realizing as I say this, I may be saying, I'm talking about a kind of a conditional feeling, and that's the truth. I feel better when I'm doing that. But I also think emotional sobriety has to do with an unconditional experience with that, a baseline that I'm not necessarily speaking to right now. So, but feel good.
In your therapist's view, was the dude a procrastinator?
What's the you mean
Jeffrey
the
Lebowski.
dude the dude was he a procrastinator? He wasn't, if you think about it.
That's what
He
I
just
thought,
got
yeah.
up. He just got up and went over to the other Lebowski's house, and when he, and then he got out of that room, he just went and got the rug that nobody told him he could have. No, he's a doer. The only problem with him is he hated the fucking Eagles.
Yeah, that's a point against, I'd say.
Oh yeah.
All right, well, let's get started. I'm going to share the screen with you guys so that we can all read this together. The Zinger from January 2024 by Steve G from Rockville, Maryland. My doctor and I agreed. I was too shaky for outpatient treatment. I needed the close supervision of a hospital-based inpatient program. My consumption of alcohol had reached such a high level that I would have to taper off gradually to avoid serious complications of withdrawal. That required a hospital. That much I understood. What I didn't understand was why they suggested I was an alcoholic. After all, anyone could develop a tolerance to alcohol, requiring even larger amounts to produce the same effect. That wasn't alcoholism, it was simply tolerance. That was all I had, and after 30 days in the hospital, I would be good as new and could start all over again. That was simple enough. Why bring up the question of alcoholism?
This soon became clear after they gave us a questionnaire to see if we were alcoholics. For example, if you answered yes to having a DUI, you got 4 points. I had no DUI, so I got 0 points. Fired for drinking on the job, zero again. Spouse threatened to leave, nope. As you can see, I was not accumulating enough points to be an alcoholic. And then the zinger. Have you ever been in a treatment program?
What? That meant I got points because I was sitting in one right then. The only reason I was considered to be an alcoholic was that I was in the stupid treatment program. That didn't make sense. So I came right out and asked, did they ever make a mistake and misclassify someone as alcoholic who really wasn't? I asked this question to one of the staff members who seemed to make the most sense, though, as I saw it, that was not saying much. This man was a psychologist who made the rounds each day and interviewed each of us for 15 minutes. He struck me as trustworthy, true to form. He did not give me a glib answer, but thought over the question a while. He told me that they had staff meetings every day to discuss each patient, and occasionally they did modify their initial diagnosis. Then he surprised me. In your case, it was unanimous, he said.
That got my attention. They all couldn't be wrong, could they? I had to rethink this alcoholism business. And the more I thought about it, the more I began to agree. Does a normal person drink so much he has to go into the hospital to stop? Maybe not. Likewise, maybe being in rehab was worth those points I earned because a normal person doesn't end up there, does he? I was beginning to see a pattern. I'd just taken my first step. I guess I belong there after all.
I got to go first, guys, because I've got some, this identifies so much. It's like a lot of people know that I was a director of an alcohol and drug treatment center when I was finally confronted by my wife that I needed to get sober. I'd been in the alcohol and drug treatment business for a long time. And so therefore I was aware of the MAST and all the other evaluation things. And I was always so proud that I didn't have a DUI because it always did have so many points to it. So because I was constantly, as an alcoholic treating alcoholics, my denial system was having to work overtime to be sure I understood the difference between, because the con is to ourselves, of course, I understood the difference between me and those guys. And, what I remember, I think on the MAST, I think that DUI was worth 5 points. And it's like, I'd never had a DUI. Until I had, talk about, here's my zinger. Until I had a guy ask me this, when I said, and I told him that with pride one day, and he said, how many DUIs have you qualified for? I mean, I can still feel that in my chest. I mean, because the answer was every fucking day of my life. It's like, I always, and then when I started to get into understanding what that meant, who I was putting in danger, because when we get into driving and drinking, I mean, I'm the first one on the front lines to give a lecture. So this doesn't have anything to do with your alcoholism. It has to do with your threatening the children on the streets, It's, as far as my breaking down my own denial, it was downhill from there. I finally realized all of those evaluations had to do with how much I got caught, I'm really good at not getting caught. I always have been, So just because I can get away with it doesn't mean, that's what happened to this guy. He just lucked out.
Right.
So anyway, I love that one. Yeah.
Speaks
to me.
Spoke to me too. It reminded me of a questionnaire I took after I had gotten a DUI arrest in Atlanta more than 10 years ago. And I, as part of my charge, we ended up pleading it down to something so that I wouldn't have a DUI on my record. I had to go into a drug and alcohol counseling center And I had to sit there and do the questionnaire, and then this guy would evaluate whether or not I needed, I was on the spectrum of addiction and I needed further treatment. And so anyway, I was Googling like mad before I went in. Is there a way that I can beat the questionnaire? And is there a way that I could lie to this guy and answer falsely the correct questions so that I wouldn't need to come back? So it would just be a one-off. And then there's something about when I sat down opposite this man. He had a very like warm, disarming, personality, and he seemed genuinely like interested in me and caring about my state. And so anyway, I just answered honestly in the moment. I spontaneously decided to just leave all that stuff to the side, and wouldn't you know it, I was definitely an alcoholic and an addict, and he prescribed, I think it was like 6 weeks of counseling, which I credit that as kind of like the beginning of my recovery, even if it took me a while to get any serious sobriety after that. I think just showing up to this building, and I was so lonely at that time in my life. I would even like stay after and talk to the counselor in his office and stuff, and couldn't stay sober, but like I was drawn to that world, and but yeah, emotional sobriety is about an alignment with reality. Or it fosters a closer alignment between us and reality. And that's what the person in the story had to come to grips with, right? Is like, no, this is actually, I need to let the medicine in.
Well, you also added, we should add something to the new questionnaires, which is, have you ever Googled how to beat the questionnaire?
Yeah.
You think that's not a symptom of alcoholism? You know, my goodness.
Yeah.
Ellen, they got you early on. I mean, how old were you when you got back from Vietnam and ended up getting into recovery?
I was 19, Tom.
Wow.
That's
19.
amazing. It's like, and I know you had made up plenty of ground getting a history of it with drugs and alcohol before then.
I took the
You were
best.
a high achiever. I know.
I was a high achiever. I was a I know I you know I'm coming up on celebrating 53 years, and I know without a doubt that I would have died from this disease. There's no question about it.
I just remain in awe of anybody who made it through their 20s sober. It's like I know I
Me
haven't ever
too.
experienced it, but I have some good friends. I'm going to have dinner with some friends that got like you has, was a high achiever early on, but he was sober by the time he was 18, and he's not as old as us, but he's like 50, upper 50s. To me, it just shows, anybody can do this.
On your website, Alan, when you talk about that moment when you were, I think you were arrested, you were at an airport, there was like a series of events that precipitated your recovery. And like, is that man recognizable to you anymore? Like, it's been so much work and so much time. Like, I just don't see even like a germ of that guy in you anymore. Is that like what recovery can get you after enough time and effort?
It's I still see that kid in me. I think Tom and we talk about having that young self inside of you, right? Some ways he's very close to me all the time. But I wanted to tie this article into something. When he realized, when they said, one of the questions was, have you ever been in treatment for your alcoholism? And that's what helped him accept his diagnosis. See, the process there is that he was so alienated from himself, he could not be aware and be honest with himself about what was really going on. And see, that's such a critical part of emotional sobriety and why they included that in this January issue on emotional sobriety. Because his waking up and starting to own and take responsibility for what he was doing was so critical and so important in the scheme of everything. So that's the lens that I want you guys to think about looking at that article through. Is there's a lot of things we don't know about ourselves. As, Tom was making some reference to that earlier. And the more we start to learn about ourselves, the more we can now access those particular areas and bring them into our functioning today and become a more effective person. That's the bottom line. And so that article to me was very important in that regard. And look, this whole thing, and next time we get together, we'll just kind of summarize. you know, what we learned through going through the grapevine and stuff like that about emotional sobriety. But it's really good news that the word is starting to carry and people are starting to pay attention to this. Workshop I did yesterday, this one woman I met up at the Wilson House when I did the workshop up there, she came back and she started a book study. She's got five women that get together and go through my book. That's the experience I'm having, which I'm glad, grateful for. All right, guys, till next time.
See you. Peace.
Happy Sunday to you all.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.